Welcome, everyone. Before we get started, I'd just like to thank the British Society of Aesthetics and the Institute of Philosophy for supporting this event. It's my pleasure to introduce our speaker for today, Dr. Robert Simpson. Rob is Associate Professor in the Department of Philosophy at UCL. He's written extensively on issues in social and political philosophy, especially issues relating to freedom of speech. And today he's going to be talking to us about experiments in living, commercial entertainment, and free speech. Take it away, Rob.
Thanks, Tim. Thanks, everyone, for coming. It's really nice to be here. I've been meaning to attend the Londoner Studies Forum for about 3.5 years, which is not about the length of time that I've been in London, but I've been departmental tutor at UCL since not long after I arrived here, and that sort of chewed up a lot of my time for the first few years, and then there was a pandemic. But anyway, now that the pandemic is perhaps, well, you know, now that we can meet in person again, it's a real pleasure to be here, and thanks very much to Alex for the invitation. I'm not an aesthetician, except in the trivial sense that all of us are aestheticians, but I have been reading in a sort of dilettantish way in aesthetics for the last 3 or 4 years, because there's this book that I want to write, which is about free speech and some subset of commercial entertainment. I'm still thinking about how to set it up exactly. I've got things that I'd like to say about pop music, things that I'd like to say about cinema, and things that I'd like to say about commercial fiction. So I've been making incremental progress getting my head around some of the writing by aestheticians on these topics that's related to what I want to say. But the real motivation for this book that I'm writing isn't some problem or difficulty that I've come to through reading aesthetics. It's a frustration I have with free speech theory and its characteristic forms. There's a handout at the back if you want to grab that. Or maybe we're out of handouts. I have a few more here. I have a frustration with free speech theory. This is the main topic that I work on. It's not a topic that's particularly owned by philosophers. People working free speech theory, many of them are legal scholars and then sometimes also political theorists and people in other humanities disciplines. There's lots of people writing about free speech, and I think the way that they are portraying free speech doesn't represent it in its most flattering light. As any of us who follow the culture wars are aware, there's a kind of growing mistrust of free speech as an idea among many, on the left at least, this sense that free speech is in some sense a reactionary ideal, that it serves the interests of existing power relations, that it somehow reinforces and reifies the status quo, and that at the very least we have reason to be suspicious about appeals to free speech, and maybe we have some even stronger reason to reject those appeals. And so that I think that's a completely benighted way of thinking. I think there's at least a grain of truth in this sort of progressive critique of free speech that we see becoming more and more prominent. But I think part of the power of the critique owes to the fact that defenders of free speech have not done a particularly good job at describing the tradition and the social practices that they are meaning to defend. So they've offered theories of what free speech is, why we should care about it, etc., etc. And I think those theories, in some sense, misrepresent the principles and practices that the people are trying to defend. And one of the main ways in which they misrepresent it, I think, is by marginalizing the place of popular culture. So a lot of free speech controversies center around pop culture. They center around novels, movies, pop music, these things being suppressed either by state action or by the actions of publishers or platforms. Think of like recent controversies about people's music being taken off Spotify. We routinely see liberals rushing to the defense of pop culture and saying, this is an instance of the kind of thing we have reason to protect. And I think that people trying to theorize and defend free speech would do well to spend more time puzzling about that. Why do we include, this anticipates some of the things I'm going to say in the first section. Why do we include forms of music or cinema that don't seem to have any particularly evident aesthetic or ethical virtues? Why do we think of those as the kind of thing that it's really important to protect from suppression, whether from government or private actors, alongside other things like political dissent, academic research, journalism. It doesn't seem like pop culture has the same sort of values and benefits to society as those things. That's not to say it has no values and benefits, but it doesn't seem to be kind of playing the same kind of role as those things. So why do we bundle it together with those things? I think if we can offer an answer to that question, the result of that is that the tradition gets cast in a different light. The reasons why we want to care about free speech in the first place and why we protect it somehow look a little bit more multifarious, and it doesn't look quite as reactionary and conservative as it might have looked if you thought about it in a way that kind of marginalised this. So I'll say more about that in the first section of the talk. That's kind of section one. Section two, I'll say a bunch of stuff about experiments and living. Ostensibly, the claim is going to be that there's a lacuna in free speech theory. We don't say enough about these pop culture things. And if we wanted to say more about them and explain and justify why we want to protect them, we would need to talk about this value that's kind of marginalised in the discourse, which is experiments and living. And then in the third section, I'll just say a little bit about why you might think that at least some forms of commercial entertainment have an important role to play in facilitating experiments in living. And I'll also say a little bit at the end just to situate my claims about commercial entertainment in relation to other kinds of claims that people have made about it. And that's really the only place where any aesthetics is coming in. I'll say a little bit about people who have had a kind of negative take on popular entertainment and a few people who've had a more positive take on popular entertainment and where I see my account of it fitting in relation to those. Okay, so let's go from there. Okay. Can I just check, Alex? I should talk for about an hour and then field questions for about an hour. Is that right? Okay. So I'm now at heading number one, free speech theory and a striking lacuna. On most accounts, there are two elements of a free speech principle. The first element is that we have some kind of firm prohibition on restricting speech or suppressing speech where the motive for the suppression is the content of the speech. And then second, even in those cases where the motive for suppression isn't the content of the speech, we have what people would sometimes describe as a thumb on the scales in favour of protecting rather than suppressing the relevant speech. So just to unpack what that means a little bit, suppose you say, look, the reason why I want to restrict people going around saying racist things isn't because I'm kind of claiming moralistically that racism is wrong. Maybe I think racism is wrong, I probably do, but that's not why I'm wanting to suppress racist hate speech. I'm wanting to suppress racist hate speech because I think, you know, in the relevant context, it has a kind of a discriminatory function. It functions as a form of hostile environment harassment. You know, it makes the relevant institution somehow, you know, it limits equality of access to the institution, whatever it may be. So that's my motive, right? My motive is harm prevention. It's the kind of motive that we want governments to be legislating on the basis of, right? It's not them coming in and trying to sort of impart their moral worldview to us. So the second principle says that even where the motive is like that, where it's not moralistic, nevertheless, if the thing that is being suppressed is speech, there's the strength of the justification that has to be offered for its suppression is stronger than if it were some other kind of conduct, right? There's something special about speech, which means that governments and maybe also private actors have to err on the side of non-interference and non-suppression, even in those cases where they have a legitimate reason for wanting to suppress it. So those are our two kind of elements of a free speech principle. Now, if that principle is going to be workable, we have to have some way of distinguishing speech from stuff that isn't speech. We have some way of identifying what are the things which, if they were to be restricted, and activate this second part of the principle, which says you have to have a thumb on the scales. So how would you do that? Well, a natural starting point would be to think of it just as a natural kind of distinction. Say, well, there's linguistic expression, and then there's other kinds of behavior. And you have to have a thumb on the scales in favor of protecting things when it involves linguistic expression. that runs into some problems very quickly. So, like, let me give you one example, but there's many that could be offered. Imagine that we have someone who's been arrested and charged with some sort of serious act of criminal fraud, where they signed some contract saying they were going to deliver work and got paid and then just absconded with the money. And they were dragged before the courts and they said, well, this is an outrage because that contract that I wrote and signed, that was an instance of me exercising speech. And this prohibition on my act of fraud is some sort of infringement upon my right to free speech. So that looks like an abuse of the concept of free speech. But the activity in question is an act of linguistic expression, right? Okay, so we need some way of thinking about what speech is that draws a distinction between something like speech that's being used to express an idea or convey a viewpoint and speech that's being used to perform some kind of act. So maybe what we could do, and this is the second sub-point here, is have some non-evaluatively defined subset of act of linguistic expression. When I say non-evaluatively defined, I mean it's a purely descriptive definition. There's like, well, here's one kind of speech, here's another kind of speech, and the stuff we want to protect is this kind. Think about those of you who are familiar with Austin's famous How to Do Things with Words. In the first few chapters of How to Do Things with Words, Austin entertains the idea that we could divide up the domain of speech acts into two categories. There's performative utterances and constative utterances. Constative utterances are roughly utterances that purport to say something, to put forward a view. Performative utterances are those cases where you're using your words to perform a particular act, like making a contract or making a promise or whatever it may be. So maybe what we want to protect is constative utterances, and then performative utterances don't necessarily enjoy any special protection. So problems arise in that case too, not so much because the distinction doesn't necessarily track the things we care about, although I think there are some worries in that direction, but actually because the distinction just breaks down under scrutiny, right? And this was much of the point of that Austin was trying to make in How to Do Things with Words, that initial first pass way of dividing up the terrain doesn't work. And it doesn't work because, as Austin argues, all of our utterances tend to have, you know, as we might put it, a performative and a constative dimension. And that's why he develops in the second half of that work a more kind of fine-grained taxonomy. And it's not so much about trying to sort speech acts into these two classes as to saying these are the different dimensions of our utterances. There are illocutionary dimensions, locutionary, imperlocutionary dimensions. So that's one problem with the non-evaluative subset approach. Another problem is that it seems like some of the things we might want to protect under the rubric of a free speech principle are things that don't involve linguistic expression at all. Musical performances, for instance, or artistic representations that don't have any words in them and so on. So I think where we get, if we spend enough time worrying about these difficulties in how we define our class of speech, is to say, well, we have to define it using some evaluative criterion. This idea that we could do it in a purely neutral descriptive way just isn't going to work. What we get then is, and this is the fourth dot point under that subheading, an evaluatively defined subclass of communicative acts, namely all and only those communicative acts that we have good reasons to partially immunize against suppression in view of the ideals that these acts promote or honour. So there's no pretense to going out there and identifying a kind of neutral, natural kindish distinction between speech and non-speech, and then somehow it turning out that we want to protect the speech and not the non-speech. What we're doing, rather, is we're just thinking, okay, are there some of our communicative acts that play a particularly important role in our society, that are particularly important in our flourishing, whatever it may be? Let's just zero in on those, and we'll almost like stipulatively define speech as those things. I think that's the best option, as if you find it kind of unacceptably ad hoc, I think that's, you know, that might just be the best that we can do if we want to make free speech theory viable. Then there's two things we could do to try to put a finer point on things. One option is to just say, okay, well, here are all the things that we care about, all the communicative acts that are important to us, and we'll just call all of that speech, and that's what most people who write about this want to do. In other work, I've defended an alternative approach where I say, let's not bundle everything together, let's just stop talking about free speech and just talk about special liberties that can be afforded to all of the communicative acts that we take ourselves to have special reasons to protect. So I rattle off a list of them. They're the kinds of things that most people who think about these things would agree, need special protection, protest, political dissent, preaching and proselytization, other forms of conscientious expression, investigative journalism, editorial opinion, gadflying or being a kind of a troll and a provocateur, scientific research, humanities scholarship, academic teaching, music, visual arts, cinema, theatre and literature. Okay, and I think either of those options are fine. You know, I do think there are good reasons to entertain the second one, but they're not really of any great importance for what I'm going to be arguing today. So now that we've figured out what speech is for the purposes of a free speech principle, the million-dollar question is, why should we afford special protections to some of this stuff? Okay, conventionally, many of us think that we should specially protect this stuff, but why might that be? And there's three main kinds of answers that we find cropping up again and again in the literature. There's a kind of a democratic argument, an argument that appeals to autonomy, and an argument appeals to some kind of epistemic goods like truth or understanding. The last argument is very well known because it's the one that Mill defends in On Liberty, and most contemporary free speech theory kind of takes Mill as its starting point. The autonomy-based arguments, there's a deontological and a consequentialist version of the argument. The consequentialist version would say these kinds of communicative acts, if you let government suppress them as if they're no different to any other act, the long-term effect of that is some kind of dulling of our capacity to be self-governing people. So it's a consequentialist argument. We will better realize our capacity for autonomy if these things are somehow immunized or partially immunized against government restriction. And then there's the more deontic sort of spin on the argument, which would be to say, look, independently of whether this has the function of promoting our autonomy, there is some sort of dishonoring of our status as autonomy beings that is constituted by restrictions on these sorts of things. And that is a reason enough to disallow such restrictions. Similarly, with the democracy-based argument, there's a kind of a more consequentialist and a more deontological version of the argument. The consequentialist one roughly says our democracy goes better if we protect all this stuff. The deontological one says something like, it's a condition of democratic legitimacy that we protect this stuff. So we're not even really living in a democracy unless we specially insulate things like protest and journalism from government regulation. You might think, just this is a quick aside, you might think, why not also include a libertarian argument which says that the government can't be trusted to regulate this stuff? And that's why we want to protect it. It's not because it has any particularly special connection to democracy or autonomy. It's just that governments are full of, you know, powerful people who've been corrupted by their power, and they're likely to abuse that power if we don't put special barriers in place for them in how they restrict this stuff. The reason why I don't think that argument is particularly interesting, I think it just kicks the can down the road. Because remember, the claim that we're making is that speech is different from other kinds of acts, that we have to have a thumb on the scale in favour of protecting it from government suppression and maybe other forms of suppression as well. If your claim is governments can't be trusted, the question immediately arises, why aren't you an anarchist? If you think that governments abuse their power, why do you think government should have power to levy taxes or to run militaries or to have, you know, well, to do any of the things that governments do, right? To run the criminal justice system. I mean, there's just as many reasons to be worried about governments abusing all of those powers as there are these powers. If there's going to be an adequate answer to that question, it's like, well, governments are even more dangerous, even more liable to abuse their power when it comes to this subset of the things that they might want to regulate. And then the question, okay, why? What is it about that subset of things such that the government, we have more reason to fear government overreach in those cases? And we're just back where we were before. We need some explanation of why these behaviours are somehow implicated in values in ways that other things aren't. And I think that pushes us back towards thinking about democratic or epistemic or autonomy-based justifications for protecting it. Okay, so I think there's a striking lacuna in this theory. How am I going for time? Okay. I think with most of the communicative acts that we ordinarily find included among the plurality of narrowly defined subclasses of protected communication, that is to say all of the things that I list above, protest, political dissent, preaching, etc., with most of them it's pretty easy to tell a story about how those acts promote or honour either democratic, epistemic, or autonomy-related ideals. could go through them one by one. I mean, that would take too long for today's purposes, but you don't have to be terribly creative to sort of join the dots. What's the connection between protest and some of these ideas? Well, it seems like you can't have a democracy unless you protect people's right to protest. What's the connection between investigative journalism and these ideas? Well, that seems to have a connection to democracy. It also seems to have a connection to our epistemic ideals, whatever they may be. And likewise for all these things, I think for each of the things that standardly shows up on the list, you can tell a really straightforward story about how the relevant ideals are connected to the relevant forms of expression and communication. I think it's harder to tell such a story with pop music and cinema. I don't think it's impossible. I think, you know, if you wanted to try to tell a story about the place of pop music in democracy or the place of pop music in promoting certain epistemic ideals, I think there is a story to be told. I think there's a mismatch between the plausibility of the story and the strength of the convictions that most of us feel, if those of us who do have kind of liberal intuitions and convictions about these things. If we think it would be a disgrace for the government to somehow be given the power to decide which pop songs can be played on Spotify, or if they were given, if we allowed them to have this, you know, as until very recently in this country did have the power to simply disallow people from watching certain movies because they were deemed too violent or too depraved, that there would be something disgraceful about that, that this would be a profound infringement of something that we care about very deeply. Suppose you had that as your starting conviction, and then someone's like, well, why? What, can you unpack that for me? Why do you feel that it would be such an affront to you and to everyone else if this particularly grotesque horror movie was something that you were just unable to watch because the government decided as much? If they were to try to explain, vindicate that intuition by appealing to cinema's connection, horror cinema's connection to democracy or to truth and understanding, I would be very skeptical. I would feel like there's a mismatch between the kind of story you're trying to tell and the value that you're using to try to underpin that story. Now, you might think that the most promising option here is to tell a story about the connection between popular entertainment and autonomy. And indeed, I think that's the thing that's nearest the mark. But I want to argue that, and this will kind of maybe become clear a little bit in the second section, I don't think an autonomy-based argument for why we should be able to watch particularly grotesque horror films, or why we should be able to listen to heavy metal music that has white supremacist themes, or rap music that's really grotesquely misogynistic and homophobic, I don't think an autonomy-based justification gets you far enough. It certainly gets you, there's obviously a profound infringement against the creators of those works if they aren't, their autonomy seems severely inhibited if they aren't able to make their creative work available to an audience. So that at least I think there's an argument to be made in that direction. But that doesn't yet do enough to explain why you and I, as potential consumers of those things, have experienced some sort of serious infringement on our autonomy if we're not able to access them. Now, if you think that there is, I perhaps haven't said enough to fully convince you on this. I think there's more to be said, but for the sake of argument, suppose you think there is something a bit odd about the place of pop culture on this long list of protected things. It's harder to join the dots between pop culture and these values that underpin free speech theory. Why then have liberals wanted to die on this hill? Why have they sought a protected status for these things? One hypothesis you could have is that this is kind of just a mistake, that it's a custom, that there's some arbitrary fixation on these things that doesn't really withstand the scrutiny that we might want to give to it, and you can't tell the story about the connection between these things and the underlying values, and we should sort of let it go. We should actually just stop treating these things as part of the protected core of free speech. The alternative, and I guess the view that I'm interested in and want to defend, is to say that there's some missing ideal in our theory, that there is a way of explaining the special importance of these things, but that we're going to have to invoke an ideal beyond the three big ones that show up over and over again in free speech theory. And the missing ideal is what I want to talk about in section two, experiments in living. So, roughly defined, experiments in living are attempts to carry out different lifestyles in pursuit of some ideal. We get the phrase from Mill, the third chapter of On Liberty. The way On Liberty is set up, for those of you who've never read it, ostensibly what Mill is trying to show in that text is that there's three kinds of behaviors which are extra special important for human well-being, such that if we don't put some extra layer of protections around those behaviors, the inevitable consequence of that will be a severe diminishing in human well-being across society. And the three kind of areas where he thinks we need a special degree of liberty are thought and opinion, freedom of speech, broadly speaking, lifestyle, and the third one is associations. And this concept of experiments and living shows up in the chapter where he tries to explain why there is a deep and profound connection between freedom in our lifestyle and our well-being in this larger sense that he's interested in later in his career. So early in his career, Mill had a kind of hedonic conception of well-being, not very different from Bentham's conception, and then he suffered a bit of a kind of a theoretical and personal crisis, and in the wake of that, revised his conception of well-being so that it's something that's not merely about pleasure or happiness, but something more like the realization of our distinct individuality, and something to do with the exercise of our distinctively human capacities for ethical and aesthetic judgment. So that's what it means to have well-being in the higher order sense that Mill's particularly interested in later in his career. He thinks that we need freedom in these three areas in order to get that. So experiments in living is a way of, I guess, describing what happens in a society where you do have special protections for people to exercise freedom in their lifestyle, and then people exercise that freedom using some degree of creativity and individuality to therefore kind of live out variations on the existing forms that are given to them by their society. So rather than simply replicating the existing social customs and practices, they play around with them and they do different things. And that's what experiments in living refers to. Elizabeth Anderson has this really nice paper from about 30 years ago, quite early in her career, where she offers a kind of a theoretical reconstruction of Mill's account of experiments in living to put particular emphasis on the importance of people not merely playing around with different lifestyle formats, but doing so in the service of some ideal. So Anderson makes a very compelling argument to say this is really what Mill had in mind. He kind of alludes to this in On Liberty, but in order to see why this is important to his account, you have to kind of read On Liberty alongside a few other texts, including the famous essay on utilitarianism, Mill's autobiography, and she makes some interesting connections to a few of his essays on poetry. The idea is that what we want in order to realize our capacity for individuality isn't simply to vary the way that we live and to resist custom for the sake of resisting custom. We want to live in the service of ideals. That's what it takes to kind of exercise our higher order capacities. It's not to say that, well, I'll come to this in a moment, but the point is to be invested in the idea of experiments in living isn't to think that mere nonconformity is a good thing. The bare fact that someone is flouting a set of conventions and customs isn't yet a thing to celebrate. What we want is for people to be flouting conventions and customs because some ideal gets a grip on them and they feel compelled to do it because there's something that they are seeking and they're not feeling bound by conventions and customs. So Anderson's reconstruction of Mill puts a little bit more emphasis on that second point than Mill himself does, and I think that's a good way to go. So I want to go reasonably briskly here. Yeah, I need to accelerate. How should we interpret different lifestyles for the purpose of this formulation? One thought you might have is that people really need to be trying out completely novel and unheard of things. And I don't think that's the best way to interpret what Mill is on about. When I say it's not the best way, I mean both that it's not the most plausible reading of the text, nor is it a way of interpreting things that gets you the most plausible theory independently of what Mill himself said and thought. I think it's fine for different lifestyles to be simply new for the actor rather than completely novel and unthought of. I think it's fine for them to be not even completely new for the actor so much as just tweaks and variations and hybridizations of lifestyles that they've had before. Right? So it doesn't have to be quite as cataclysmic as, for instance, someone who's lived a very buttoned-down lifestyle becoming a completely kind of extravagant and outgoing person. It could just be modest variations in their lifestyle inspired by some sense that something is missing or that something that's been present is unhealthy for them. It doesn't have to be someone giving up their religion or changing religions. It could be someone modifying the way they practice their own religion. Right? The point is about modification and adjustment, not the scale and scope of the modifications. Insofar as it has to be a different lifestyle in pursuit of some ideal, you might think that in order for that part of the formulation to be satisfied, people have to have a very conscious sense of the ideals that they're acting in the service of, that they have to be able to name and articulate what those ideals are and what they care about them. I don't think there's any particular reason to build that into the account. Nor, perhaps slightly more controversially, do I think it needs to be the case that the ideals people are acting in the service of have to be ethical ideals. So the way Mill's ethical thinking here isn't that we want a society of saints, and that's how the good in the global sense is achieved. Rather, it's we want a society of people being themselves, and that is a global good. Now, admittedly, that might start to look like an implausible view if everyone turned out to be kind of dastardly and selfish and so on, but Mill's a bit more of an optimist about human nature than that. He thinks if we afford people the possibility to live in a way that makes sense to them, in the pursuit of the ideals that they feel gripped by, what we will see is, you know, mostly people living in ways that are pro-social and, you know, conducive to their own and other people's happiness. But it's not because we want people to be pro-social that we do it. We want people to become their distinct individuated selves. That means pursuing some ideal. It doesn't matter whether the ideal is particularly ethically admirable in its own right. So how is being in favour of experiments and living different from being in favour of mere autonomy? I need to be brisk here. The gist of my thought is that I think you can exercise your autonomy over some finite set of decent lifestyle options. So there's a couple of different ways you might conceive of what autonomy is. You might think of it as something about ability to act in accordance with reason or your own deliberation. You might think about it as something to do with being independent from the controlling influence of other people. I think on either of those broad conceptions of what autonomy is, you don't need to have an ever-evolving range of lifestyle options in order to be autonomous. You do need some decent range of options to choose from. But if you have that decent range, then you can govern yourself in both of these senses. You don't have to be beholden to other people's plan for your life. You're able to deliberate and act on the basis of your deliberations and so on. So basically, that's why I think we would need to conceive of experiments in living as something that's not simply reducible to autonomy. Because if you care about experiments in living, you necessarily care about some kind of ongoing proliferation in the range of lifestyle options in a way that being committed to autonomy by itself doesn't necessitate. Someone might want to say, well, look, when I was talking about autonomy and saying that I think autonomy is an important value and one of the values that underpins free speech theory, this thing that you're talking about that's necessarily connected to a proliferation of lifestyle options, that was part of what I meant to capture under the label of autonomy. I think that's a perfectly... I mean, there's no reason for the view that I'm developing here to kind of strenuously resist that suggestion. I think it's kind of, you know, it's kind of... largely a question of labelling, but insofar as Mill has a kind of a conception of experiments and living that differentiates it from autonomy, I'm minded to treat it separately as well. Now, so far I haven't said much about why any of this is something that actually makes sense to care about, and it's going to be difficult to do that at length. Really, that's a paper in its own right, but very briefly, Mill cared about it because he thought that this was really the only way for us to get higher order utility. Ryan Muldoon has recently argued that experiments in living are necessary if we want to have high quality policy justifications in a pluralistic society. There would be a way to argue for experiments in living by simply insisting that they're valuable in their own right. You could make an argument appealing to some further ideal of authenticity. Say, well, the real underpinning value here is authenticity, and experiments in living are instrumentally valuable insofar as they enable us to realize our authenticity. The argument that I find most plausible is one that appeals to the value of diversity. And this is very much inspired by Mill. I think Mill has this vision of what a healthy society looks like, which is that it's like a really biodiverse forest, and where each tree has been able to grow without being chopped or trained, that it's just, you know, kind of wild growth, and it takes whatever shape is somehow created by the combination of its own intrinsic creative potential and the point, the position in the landscape where it happens to take root, and then the tree takes its own distinctive shape. And Mill wants a society that somehow metaphorically looks the same, where all of us become shaped and molded in the way that is given to us by the combination of whatever intrinsic properties we have and the place we find ourselves, and we're not trained along some particular path. So this brings us to the interim summary. Let me just read through this. Liberal societies prize not only autonomy in people's lifestyle choices, but also a proliferation in the range of choosable lifestyles that are available in a society. Radicalism and genuine novelty are valued, but so too are low-key tweaks, variations, and hybridizations. Totally arbitrary variation isn't necessarily prized, but the ideals that motivate variations don't have to be bold, urgent, or altruistic. They can be modest, non-urgent, and self-centered. And they don't necessarily have to be consciously recognized or theorized, so long as they are not just arbitrarily embraced. The bigger picture good that is served by experiments in living exists only at a collective level. It is about human societies manifesting greater diversity in good or decent forms of life. Okay, I'm just going to skip over that next point because I'm running out of time. So if you buy all that, and obviously there's a number of places that you might want to get off the bus before this point, but if you're following the kind of Millian way of thinking about experiments and living up to this point, one worry that you might then have is, how do we actually do this? How do we make good on this ideal? It's one thing to say that governments have to stand back and not try to impose customs and conventions upon us in an onerous way. But then for each of us trying to become distinct individuals, how are we to do that, given that, you know, we can't just treat this, most of us can't afford to treat this as our life's project, to become the distinct and authentic individual I am. We've got to get on with the business of living. We've got material needs to fulfill. We've got responsibilities to other people, etc. So a few ways of trying to just spell out the challenges that we face in conducting experiments in living. One is that trying out different lifestyles is costly, both in terms of time and material resources. Another is that if it's supposed to be adjustments in our lifestyle motivated by our responding to some new or different ideal, then presumably we have to spend time reconsidering and renegotiating our ideals, and that's kind of intellectually arduous. There's also problems of timing. Carrying out experiments in living when you're a child sort of seems futile, because as a child you don't really know what your adult self, how you're going to be socially stationed and what kind of personality you will have and so on. I mean, I'm just not to say that there's a bad thing, but it doesn't seem like a good strategy for realizing Mill's vision is to simply give children a lot of freedom to, you know, play around and be different people if they then get sort of pressured into a very demanding set of requirements as soon as they, you know, become adults. Equally, too much experimentation late in life has its own downsides. It can result in people feeling very alienated. You think of the classic example of someone who has a midlife crisis and starts behaving in ways that embarrass his family, embarrass himself, maybe, you know, betrays various commitments that he might have had earlier along the way. There's something, I mean, roughly the thought here is that at a certain point you have to commit to a course of life, and then in making that commitment, you sort of are tying yourself to the mast to some extent, to simply renege on all those commitments because, hey, Mill told me that it's good for us to experiment doesn't seem the ideal way to approach it. So if you care about experimentation, individuality, people becoming their own, you know, the becoming the tree that they were destined to be and so on, there is this kind of complicated temporal thing where there are moments in life where it seems possible for people to try on different personalities, try out different lifestyles, renegotiate their ideals, It's not that it has to happen at one particular moment, but there are difficulties of timing. And then the third thing that I mentioned there is the Hannah Horvath problem. This is the protagonist of the TV show Girls. There are ways that this can go wrong, even if it's someone sort of being their experimental self at the time in life where it makes no sense, sort of in the transitional period between adolescence and adulthood. Essentially, if you become too self-absorbed with the question of like, who am I meant to be and what is my distinct individual place in life supposed to look like, that can lapse into a form of unproductive narcissism. Finally, I think there are interesting motivational problems here. The way I put it on the handout, how does one get internal reasons to reconsider one's ideals? Your reasons for living in a particular way are presumably given to you in some sense by the ideals and understandings that you possess at a given time. To come to the conclusion rationally that some different set of ideals are the ones that you really ought to answer to seems like some weird kind of leap of logic or leap of faith. How could that? What would it mean to do that in a way that wasn't simply arbitrary or lacking in any kind of deeper explanation and justification? One possible response would be to appeal to what Agnes Callard calls the idea of proleptic reason. So you can have reasons for pursuing certain activities that, in a sense, would only really fully feel the force of those reasons once you had been changed into being the kind of person to whom those activities now make a kind of sense. So she has examples like getting into opera. If you know nothing about the opera, then you don't really have reasons to care about the opera, but you might sort of just act as if you do. And in doing that, and then going to the opera and starting to understand its particular kind of aesthetic appeal, you might make yourself the kind of person for whom those reasons are no longer external reasons, they're now internal reasons. But still, I think that the question remains of how to do that in a way that isn't completely arbitrary. Right? If you feel some lack in your life in its current form, like, I feel like the ideals that I currently subscribe to are incomplete or not quite right, and I want to somehow open myself up to a different set of ideals, what are you supposed to do? You just spin a big wheel and see where the ticker stops. If that's what the idea of being experimental in one's lifestyle boils down to, you might just worry that it seems a little bit too fluky and arbitrary. Okay, so how might commercial entertainment play a role in facilitating experiments in living, given the account of what experiments in living are that I've just sketched out for you, and given the difficulties with non-arbitrary experimentation that I've just alluded to, why might commercial entertainment be a helpful thing to have available to you? And let me begin with some observations and conjectures. I'm going to focus on pop music here. Part of the difficulty with this project, which I'm still just puzzling over, is how narrow or broad to make it. I do think I want to focus on sort of mass market entertainment, pop culture. I don't think I want to make it about the arts in a much broader sense. So here I'm perhaps going a little bit narrower than I ultimately want to go with the project, but I feel more confident making these claims about pop music than I do making them about commercial entertainment as such. So, pop music. Largely driven by young people's tastes, centered on late adolescence, the pop music industry expands in concert with what some social theorists have called the invention of the teenager. The word teenager, I believe, was only coined in the 1940s, and the idea of adolescence as this moment that's kind of a sharp distinction between childhood and adulthood, where people somehow become individuated whilst, you know, still living with their parents, but somehow having the freedom to not simply mimic what their parents do. This is not a timeless thing. This is something that our culture came to at a particular moment. And pop music as a kind of a genre and a commercial enterprise happens in concert with this kind of sociological transformation of what it means to be an adolescent in countries like Britain and America. There's an emphasis in pop music on moods and aesthetic qualities that strike a chord with the adolescent psyche. Things like fun, sarcasm, silliness, sexiness, rebellion, anger, melancholy. Pop music has a tendency to be faddish. It has an inbuilt dynamism. It's always changing and reinventing itself. It also evinces a fascination with particular individuals and figures who seem to have a great capacity for self-reinvention. People like David Bowie or Madonna or Tyler, the Creator, or whoever it might be. It's responsive to what I would call the need for microgenerational differentiation, which is just a sort of a slightly fussy way of saying, you know, the kids want to feel like they are different from the ones that are just 2 or 3 years older than them and the ones that are just 2 or 3 years younger than them. There's this kind of Bourdieuvian desire for differentiation, and pop music creates kind of signifiers and other kinds of reference points that allow for that kind of micro-differentiation. Partly as a result of some of the things that I've just been running through, there is a tendency in pop music to invent or popularize highly stylized archetypes, things like goths, punks, teddy boys, rastas, rude boys, mods, romantic skaters, metalheads, stoners, slackers, ravers, normies, SoundCloud rappers, and so on. Accessibility for middle class and working class consumers is a strong commercial imperative. Right? We want to make as much money out of this as we can. If the products are only affordable for middle class kids or only appealing to middle class kids, there's a massive commercial opportunity that goes begging. So we want to make this truly mass market and accessible to as many young people as possible. There's commercial incentives to absorb grassroots creativity into mass entertainment. No one running record companies in America in the 1980s was particularly aesthetically drawn towards rap music. Right? Rap music was something that just started as a kind of a form of folk art on the streets of some large American cities, and it found its way into the mainstream just because it represented a commercial opportunity, not because it was particularly aesthetically valued or, you know, in any way culturally esteemed by the people running record labels. I think there is an incidental tendency in pop music, and when I say incidental, I mean not orchestrated by entrepreneurs or policy architects, to increase the visibility of marginalized demographics. And the rap music example that I gave there just represents one instance of this. Because marginalized demographics come, you know, represent to the mainstream a form of novelty and difference, there's a commercial incentive to somehow absorb what the creative forms that are coming out of those demographic groups into the mainstream and use them as, you know, new signifiers, new products, new personas, etc. I think we can observe some similar trends in cinema, although cinema is a more complicated case for a host of reasons, partly because the market for teenage-friendly cinema is less prevalent prior to the point where you have home video, you know, for the simple reason that you know, there's a way of marketing pop music to children, which is putting it on the radio. They can go to the shops on the weekend and buy tapes or records or CDs or whatever it might be. Prior to the point of there being home video, you know, it's not as easy for a bunch of 12-year-olds to go out and watch a movie together, especially if they're living in a large city, as it is for them to go to each other's houses and listen to the radio. The cost of film production, the fact that it's much more expensive to make a film than it is to make a record, makes it in some sense harder to absorb grassroots forms of creativity into the mainstream. And I think there are fuzzier demarcations between pop cinema and art cinema than there are between pop music and art music. Okay, drawing a little bit on this kind of analysis of some of the descriptive features of pop entertainment, how does this help to facilitate experiments in living? Well, I think it just solves some of the difficulties. It solves is too strong of a word. It alleviates some of the difficulties that I was alluding to before. So trying out different lifestyles is costly. Pop culture gives people a way of sampling different lifestyles cheaply, you know, in a way that's essentially about some sort of observation and mimicry without committing to a lifestyle. You see another lifestyle represented and you sort of play it following that lifestyle or something like that. Adopting new ideals is cognitively arduous. Pop culture potentially turns it into a form of play. The problems of timing that I alluded to before, I think one way of thinking about what pop culture does is that it readies young people for the experiments, the experimental moments in life, right? If the ideal time to be engaging in a bit of experimentation is in early adulthood, pop culture gives young people a training in thinking about themselves as discrete individuals, differentiating themselves from the people around them, trying to figure out their own interests so that when those moments arrive, they're kind of ready to start exploring and experimenting. The internal reasons problem, how do you feel the force of some set of ideals that don't currently make sense from within your inherited set of ideals, Well, pop culture invites experimentality not by giving people reasons in a kind of a way that's argumentative or explanatory, but sort of through seduction and sensuality. Right? People, young people get drawn into a sense of the possibility of a certain set of ideals by appreciating their aesthetic or affective qualities. In a way, I think, you know, the kind of fear that, you know, the archetypal fear of a conservative person who thinks that pop music has this corrupting potential, I don't think the fear is misplaced, right? I think the sense that, oh, you might watch a bunch of these videos and suddenly feel yourself drawn into this world and want to be a different kind of person. I mean, I just don't think that's wrong. If we object to the kind of archetypal conservative parent who's worried about that, I don't think it's because they're necessarily descriptively mischaracterizing the corrupting potential of pop music. Rather, the claim would have to be it's not really a corruption. It's something that we might want to protect. Okay, I'm running out of time, so I just want to say a few things now to try to situate the account. In my reading, trying to get my head around the aesthetics literature on pop culture so far, I feel like the people I'm reading broadly divide into two camps. There's the kind of Frankfurt School or post-Frankfurt School skepticism about pop culture. So, you know, best exemplified by Horkheimer and Adorno in the Dialectic of Enlightenment, where essentially they, it's okay, those people will have to go to a philosophy department thing that starts at 5. They're not all offended by my talk. So the Frankfurt School view would be something like pop culture is the kind of the cultural wing of predatory capitalism. It represents some sort of degraded form of humanity and certainly degraded aesthetic qualities. It flattens out people's capacity for aesthetic appreciation. It breeds a certain sort of docility or passivity and makes people more likely to accept unjust social arrangements and so on. It's the pits. And that then sort of sets a template for people who want to offer a defense of pop culture to somehow defend the aesthetic or ethical potential of pop culture. So someone like Noel Carroll offers this really kind of spirited defense of the aesthetic qualities of pop culture, essentially wanting to say that, you know, the Frankfurt School idea that what we get in pop music or mainstream cinema is inevitably a degraded set of aesthetic qualities is just a kind of snobbery masquerading as a sort of high-minded bit of social theory that, you know, once we relax our kind of high culture pretensions and try to offset our, you know, native tendency towards snobbery, we'd see that there's just as much potential for like brilliant aesthetic material to be produced through mass commercial entertainment as there is through high art institutions. Or you get someone like Tyler Cowen, who's a kind of social theorist with a background in economics, who wants to argue that there's actually something positively valuable about the intense merging of creativity and commerce that we get in pop cultural forms, because now you have not just the kind of creative incentive to try new things and to be, you know, experimental and interesting. That creative impetus gets merged with a commercial impetus, and we get a kind of an intense generation of creativity as a result of that, and that's something to celebrate. You might also think that people who are interested in the distinctive aesthetic potentials of commercial entertainment media like cinema can be understood and set up in opposition to cultural pessimists like Horkheimer and Adorno. So think of someone like Cavell trying to wrap his head around the way in which cinema has a particular set of aesthetic qualities and expressive potentials that make it really interesting and powerful and unique and so on. If you're Horkheimer and Adorno, maybe you're too wrapped up in your kind of worries about the you know, the sort of mass market docility of this form to see that there's something really interesting and distinctive going on. Now, you might think the kind of account I'm giving wants to just enthusiastically join in with the sort of anti-Frankfurt School defense of pop culture. But really, I think the takeaway is that it suggests the axes along which those debates are hashed out. It's not to say that we can't have debates about the aesthetic qualities of pop culture versus high art, that we can't have debates about the ethical potential of pop culture versus high art. But if you're the kind of liberal who really cares about free speech, I think it's a natural thing to say is that my interest in protecting pop culture is independent of those debates. So, the claim that pop culture facilitates experiments in living is logically independent of any optimistic claims about the kind of ethical or aesthetic potentials of pop culture. You don't have to say, think about the way that someone like, you know, like a Martha Nussbaum type defense of reading novels, which is it enlarges our aesthetic capacities and turns us into better people. You don't have to say that anything like that is going to happen through kids watching, you know, commercial cinema or listening to pop music or anything like that. I mean, I think there's good reasons to not make your account hinge on those claims because they are optimistic claims, right? They're also empirical claims that could turn out to be, you know, belied by the evidence. Equally, it's compatible with the very pessimistic claims about pop culture that you get from the Frankfurt School. To say that these things play a role in facilitating experiments in living doesn't commit you to saying that Horkheimer and Adorno were wrong in arguing, for instance, that the kind of aesthetic products that we get produced through these mechanisms are going to have a real kind of flattened, homogenous quality. I mean, I'm a bit skeptical about that claim for my part, but the argument isn't premised on a rejection of that, right? I mean, the key thought here, and this is the third bottom line of the handout, is that pop culture doesn't breed virtue, or taste for that matter, it breeds individuality. Now, if that's right, that's a conjecture, and it's also one that's amenable to empirical investigation, it could turn out to be false. But I think that's the explanation, that's the best explanation that a classical liberal has kind of waiting in the wings to develop, about why we would want to protect this stuff in a way that treats it as in that privileged core of forms of speech that includes things like protest, journalism, academic research, and so on. Why lump pop culture? Why not, you know, depraved horror movies in that basket with all those other things? Well, the answer is going to be that these forms of mass market commercial entertainment have a really distinctive role to play in societies like ours in kind of nurturing and encouraging individuation. The last point before section four, which I didn't cover, there's a very quick objection that you might make to this, which is to say, well, is this really true of all of the products of mass market entertainment? I mean, you've talked about pop music and cinema, but even within those subsets, isn't this just going to be true of like the really good products rather than, you know, it sounds like you're making a universal claim that this is what it always does. I don't think this is anything to worry about particularly, because the same sort of complaint applies to all of the kind of categories of protected expression. Think about journalism, right? If someone wants to say, well, journalism is really good for democracy, and you say, well, here's today's Daily Mail. Which of the following articles do you think is having any sort of positive effect on democracy, given that it's, you know, crass misinformation, et cetera, et cetera? Well, the claim wasn't each token instance of journalistic communication advances these values. The claim is that sort of the whole sphere of journalistic endeavor taken collectively advances these values, and we want to protect the whole thing because if we somehow empower governments or regulators to go through and say that's the good stuff, that's the bad stuff, we're going to protect that and suppress that, we might be very doubtful about their ability to make the right discriminations. And that doubt isn't simply premised on the thought that they might be corrupted. It might be that it's actually really, really difficult, even if they weren't acting correctly, to make those discriminations. So something similar could be true with pop music. We don't have to say, well, you know, pop culture more generally, we don't have to say that each token instance of rap, horror movies, heavy metal music, the kinds of things that people might want to suppress, we don't have to say that each of them is by itself playing an important role in facilitating independence and originality and so on. We want to say that the mass of it taken collectively is. And the very last point, actually, I should read this out for you because on your handout, the second half of this sentence disappeared because the formatting changed when I printed it. So the claim that I ultimately want to circle back around to in the eventually fully worked out version of this material is to say that if our theory of free speech adds experiments in living to its menu of justificatory ideals alongside the others that I mentioned before, what we get is something that's both more faithful to the practice of free speech politics, both in law and civil society activism, And secondly, this is the bit that's missing, more attractive to those people who see free speech as an unacceptably status quo-friendly form of politics. And really that second bit is, you know, that's part of the big picture payoff here. Those people who look at free speech with a great deal of suspicion and say, isn't this just reifying existing social forms, existing power relations? Well, I think the way that free speech functioned in the post-war era, roughly from like 1950 to 2000, was to protect certain, among other things, was to protect certain forms of cultural expression, including in mass market commercial entertainment, which, as a result of their expression, have played a really instrumental role in diversifying and transforming society. So part of the reason why I think it's important for our theory to capture this is because it casts that tradition in a more flattering light and looks much less like this thing that is just interested in preserving existing power structures than its critics have often claimed. Okay, sorry I've gone a little bit over time. I'll leave it there for now. I'm looking forward to hearing your questions.